Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Medina. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Michael Berry, and I represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Jose Medina. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Article 120 C2 is unconstitutional because of three due process violations. First, it burdens an accused with disproving an element of the crime. Second, it presumes that an alleged victim did not consent to the sexual activity. And third, it permits the government to disprove consent after it has already been proved. Turning to the first due process violation, an accused may never be burdened with disproving an element of a crime. But because of the way that Article 120 defines consent, an accused here must disprove the element of substantial incapacity. This issue boils down to the relationship between consent and substantial incapacity. Consent is defined as words or overt acts indicating a freely given agreement to the sexual conduct at issue by a competent person, and importantly...
How does this case differ from Neal?
Your Honor, this case differs from Neal because in Neal, the element of the offense, which was force, places the focus on the actor, on the accused. Here, the element of substantial incapacity is focused on the victim, on the alleged victim.
And therefore?
Therefore, Your Honor, that's one of the ways this case differs from Neal.
Well, yeah, but which way does that cut? And number two, does that make a substantive constitutional difference between Neal and this case?
Your Honor, it cuts in favor of the appellant in this case because the focus of the affirmative defense and the focus of the element are on the same party. And the reason that makes a constitutional difference is because Neal arguably falls within the first scenario presented in Humanic versus Beyer, which is where there is some overlap between the element of the
crime. What's wrong with overlap? Why, if you take away the double burden shift and the triple burden shift and the backflip, and just focus on the overlap thing, because there's a lot of moving parts here, why can't Congress say, okay, government, you prove the element of incapacitation, defense, you can argue consent, and we'll see who the members believe? Why is that unconstitutional?
That's unconstitutional here, Your Honor, because of the way in which consent is defined and the way in which substantial incapacity is defined in the statute. Those two terms, based on their definitions, become the same ultimate issue, to use the phrase of Humanic. They are two sides of the same proverbial coin.
But that's, you can defend a bank robbery, the government can say you were there and you can say you weren't. That's the same issue, two sides of the same thing. Why is that disproving an element of the offense?
In the bank robbery scenario, Your Honor, the accused would not have a burden of disproving that. He has the option of raising it, whereas here, under 120 T16, he has an affirmative burden of by preponderance of evidence. And the instruction is required under U.S. v. DiPaolo.
Counsel, talking about the instruction, I guess I have a more preliminary prudential question for you here, which is given the instruction that was actually given in this case, which did not instruct the jury that the appellant had a burden to prove anything, in fact said that the burden was on the government to prove lack of consent, why do we even reach the other issues?
I'm sorry, I said,
why do we reach the other issues in this case?
Why don't the instructions cure any problem you might have with the statute?
Because, Your Honors, the instruction does not conform with the statute. It is.
Well, but you don't like the statute, and you don't want an instruction that conforms to the statute because you say that it's facially unconstitutional. But in this case, that wasn't the instruction that was given. So, why do we reach the other issues? Other than you would like us to reach them, but I mean, as a prudential matter, why would we reach them?
Your Honor, because the military judge is bound to apply the law as it's written, and in this case...
Do you have standing to complain about the military judge not giving an instruction in the statute that you don't think should be given yourself? Maybe not standing is not the right word, but why would you come in here and make that argument?
Your Honor, the argument is that it doesn't matter what I or the military judge believes in terms of it, whether there is some purported benefit to the appellant. The issue is that the law states that the consent is an affirmative defense, and the law is that the military judge must give that instruction if some evidence is raised.
But I understand that, but in this case, you'd agree he did not give that instruction. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you agree that there's lots of case law out there that suggests that if a case can be decided on other than constitutional grounds, that that's what we should do?
Not when, under Reno versus ACLU, Your Honor, that a court will not depart substantially from the language that is provided by the legislature, even if it's to bring that statute in conformity with the Constitution.
Not departing. The military judge departed. I think that's what Judge Ryan is asking you.
Is there anything unconstitutional about the instructions that were given?
The fact that they were not in conformity with the statute, that's the constitutional error, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll put that aside. Is there anything unconstitutional other than that, in your view, about the instructions that were given that improperly shifted the burden, that whatever?
There could be, Your Honor, and it's just, without knowing more on the record, we can't say, because it's possible that the military judge in his own mind was applying the statute and simply made an interlocutory decision that the affirmative defense had been met, that the accused had provided.
So is the answer, without reading the judge's mind, there's nothing unconstitutional about the instructions that were given?
Not on its face, Your Honor, because it simply shifted. It was the old Article 120.
I appreciate your candor there.
How did your client suffer from the instructions that were given? How did they prejudice him in any way?
From the instructions given, Your Honor, the appellant can't point to any direct or tangible prejudice other than the conviction for a statute that is facially unconstitutional. So if the statute is unconstitutional on its face, there is no way in which it can be applied that it is constitutional.
So if your argument is that if you're successful in convincing us that the statute is unconstitutional on its face, we stop there. And we cannot say that there was no harm in this case because of that.
That is correct. That is appellant's understanding of the definition of a facially unconstitutional statute, is that there is, under Salerno, there is no construction which would save it, which would pass constitutional muster.
I have a question to ask you. Do you believe that if the affirmative defense portion of the statute was removed, that would obviate the constitutional problem that you're complaining of?
If I understand the question correctly, Your Honor,
I mean, your problem, as I understand it, the statute is that there's an affirmative defense that requires the appellant, the defendant, to prove by preponderance of the evidence an affirmative defense.
That's correct, Your Honor. The problem is the burden of proof.
So if that affirmative defense was removed and that preponderance of the evidence standard was removed, would there be a problem with the statute based on the portions that you're asking us to look at today?
No, Your Honor. Assuming that the statute then read that the accused would only have the burden of production, vice
versa.
Well,
we wouldn't say anything. We're taking that section out. It doesn't say anything about it. All right. So, is there a problem now with the statute?
Not on its face, Your Honor. Perhaps in the way in which it was applied, if the military judge.
So, if you remove that aspect of the statute from the statute, and if the military judge instructed as though that portion of the statute didn't exist. Again, I ask you, what is the problem here?
The problem here is because if the accused or anybody, any party at the court martial presents some evidence of consent, that the military judge would be bound to give an instruction on consent, and then we'd be in a situation in which there is that part had been removed. So appellant's position is that the statute should read that the accused would have the burden of production, that just he simply has to show some evidence. And at that point, the burden would shift to the government, much like with many traditional affirmative defenses. At that point, the burden could shift to the government to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you. I understand your position.
Counsel, just to clarify then on that, is C2 unconstitutional on its face, just looking at C2?
Yes, Your Honor, and that ties in directly with the second due process issue because of the presumption that there was no consent. Backing up, Your Honor, because of the definition of substantial incapacity and how it relates
just to... Just looking at C2 by itself, not looking at any other part of the statute, is it unconstitutional for Congress to pass a statute which says that it's an offense for a person to engage in a sexual act with someone who is substantially incapacitated?
On its, just that language alone, Your Honor, no, that is, our position is that's not unconstitutional.
Okay, then let's look at the definition. Is it unconstitutional for Congress to define consent in the manner that it defined consent?
No, Your Honor, that's not unconstitutional.
Is it unconstitutional if Congress had C2 plus the definition of consent?
No, it's the addition of the not just the definition, but it's T16, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's the part you're attacking as unconstitutional here, per your discussion with Judge Ryan.
Yes, Your Honor, as it applies to C2, because C2 is the only part of Article 120 that appellant takes issue with here, because the element of substantial incapacity and the issue of consent are so closely related. They're concentric rings. They've become the same ultimate issue.
And did the evidence in this case raise the issue of consent as an affirmative defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the military judge instruct on the issue of consent as an affirmative defense?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
Thank you.
Second due process violation is that the statute presumes that an alleged victim did not consent. Because the accused bears the burden of proving by preponderance that there was consent, then we have a default presumption that there was no consent. The due process violation occurs when a fact necessary to convict the accused is presumed in favor of the government. The government can't be relieved of its burden of proof at any time in accordance with Winship. And the members are also, or the fact finder, is the only party capable or with the authority to make that determination, not the legislature. Thus, the presumption in favor of the government that there was no consent violates due process. The third...
Is consent an element of the offense?
Not statutorily, Your Honor.
Then why is there a constitutional problem?
It goes back to the first issue, Your Honor, because of the manner in which consent is defined. It becomes this other side of the coin, a substantial incapacity.
But in the discussion we just had, I thought you agreed that C2 plus the definition would not be unconstitutional, that it was only the interjection of the affirmative defense that made it unconstitutional.
Yes, Your Honor, and it is the interjection of the affirmative defense which then creates that presumption. And because the definition of consent standing alone and the elements of the crime standing alone, if they're kept independent and separate entities, there is no issue. It's when the accused bears the burden of proving either one of those.
What if the government bore the burden of disproving the affirmative defense? Would it be unconstitutional? In other words, if Congress provides an affirmative defense, if Congress were to provide an affirmative defense of consent, and the government bore the burden of disproving the presence of consent, would that be unconstitutional?
No, Your Honor, because the government would be, I mean, it would really be burdening the government with proving X and disproving non-X at the same time.
And under the facts of this case, why didn't that happen here? That is, in terms of the way the judge approached the case and the instructions that the judge gave, why did this case not meet that situation of the judge instructing that the burden on the government both was to prove beyond a reasonable doubt substantial incapacity and to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt the presence of consent?
That didn't happen here, Your Honor, because we presume that the military judge knows the law and applies it correctly. And therefore, somebody had to make the determination that the appellant had met his burden by preponderance of evidence. And we can only presume from the facts on the record that the military judge was the one that made that determination. Because 120 T16 says, after the accused has met this burden, the government then bears the burden of disproving consent by beyond reasonable doubt.
But why, under the facts of this case, does that then become unconstitutional, irrespective of what the judge might have done subconsciously or not on the record? Why didn't the defense receive everything that it would have received under the theory that you had articulated as to where the burdens lie?
Because the defense also has the right, the accused also has the right to have the fact finder make that determination, and not, and in this case it is the members. So the members should have been the one to determine whether the accused had met his burden by a preponderance. And at that point, it becomes a legal and logical impossibility for the government to disprove that. Once something has been proved by preponderance, you can't thereafter disprove that by beyond reasonable doubt. And that gives the government a second bite at the apple. So it really, it vitiates the affirmative defense. It's called an affirmative defense in name, but it's not really what it really is.
Well, if it's logically impossible, how does it vitiate the defense? If it's logically, okay, it's been shown by preponderance of evidence. Government's supposed to now come around and disprove it by beyond reasonable doubt. You're saying that's logically impossible. If it's logically impossible, how does it undercut the defense?
Well, because at the point at which the accused proves consent by preponderance, he should be acquitted at that point. At that point, the member should say, well, we...
Well, I mean, you're treating it as a nullity, and you're also treating it as a bearer of unconstitutionality. Which is it?
Well, it's either or, Your Honor, because if it's a legal nullity, then at that point, the statute...
Well, if it's a legal nullity, then what harm is it to the appellant?
Because he was convicted, Your Honor, the fact that he's now been convicted despite having proved consent.
Your point is that preponderance of the evidence is a reasonable doubt, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. At its very least, it's a reasonable doubt. And again, because what he's seeking to prove by preponderance is consent. And consent, a prerequisite for consent is the capacity of consent. One can't prove consent without first proving that someone has the capacity to consent. And I see that I'm...
So I have an opportunity on rebuttal.
I'm sorry?
You have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron. May it please the Court. I'm Commander Buggy for the United States. The court has made many of the government's points in its questions to the defense. The government would just like to point out this is a facial challenge, which is disfavored, and the government completely agrees with the point that the court should avoid a constitutional issue if it may do so.
Counsel, I can't speak for my colleagues, but I do have confidence that the bench was raising questions and raising issues for the defense to discuss and was not making points of law for the court.
Certainly, Your Honor, I understand that. The appellant here has not overcome the high hurdle he has to clear to show that the statute is facially unconstitutional, namely that there is no set of circumstances in which the statute can be constitutionally complied. As a threshold matter, this...
Is your fundamental argument that the instructions cured any constitutional problem with the statute, or are you here to argue that everything in the statute is constitutional? Forget the instructions.
In this case, as it was applied, there was no constitutional error because the judge's instructions, even though they did not comport with the statute, cured any potential problem.
But this is a facial challenge.
This is a facial challenge. As an initial matter, this case fits within the broad four corners of Neal, even though it addressed the force versus consent, and here we have the substantial.
How do you deal with the logic of the appellant has to puts up preponderance of the evidence and the government gets to rebut that beyond reasonable doubt? How can you rebut something that is more likely than not? Isn't that inherently a reasonable doubt?
The government would not dispute that matter, Your Honor.
So is that portion of the statute unconstitutional if it were
fully played out, there could be some constitutional infirmities there, yes. The government has taken that position in other cases that
facially
T16 does prevent troublesome.
Is the government conceding that it's an unconstitutional provision if instructed as is?
The government, it is very similar to the D.C. statute in Russell and Hicks where it was found to be unconstitutional in those cases, yes, Your Honor. So it does prevent problems. As a facial matter, though, the threshold question, is C2 in isolation all by itself unconstitutional? The answer to that is clearly no. It's clearly within Congress's power to define and punish criminal offenses.
My understanding is that the defense is in agreement with that.
Yes, Your Honor, and that the real question is how do we apply here the defense of consent? The consent is looking at the words or overt acts of the complaining witness, whereas the substance of crime, which now consent cannot not necessarily has to occur at the same precise moment in time as the sexual act or the sexual contact, depending on the statutory provision at issue. The consent can occur at some different time. Nothing in any part of Article 120 says that those two things have to be looked at precisely the same.
So it's the government's view that a person can consent to a sexual act early in the day, and unless that consent's withdrawn, if the person upon whom the act is perpetrated is unconscious or not is substantially incapable of understanding what's going on, that person it cannot be the victim of sexual attack?
It would depend on the particular facts and circumstances of any particular hypothetical, but there may be a case where a person exclaims that they're very tired and they may fall asleep, but they nonetheless consent to sexual activity.
Well, let's be more specific. Why wouldn't substantial incapacity terminate any prior consent? I mean, the statutory scheme here seems to be quite clear that you cannot consent if you're substantially incapacitated. So even if you consent earlier in the day and then the individual becomes substantially incapacitated, we're not going to argue whether that happened. We're going to assume that happened. Would not that negate any prior consent?
Well, there's nothing in the statutory language that says that consent is automatically negated by...
So how long does that consent last? Does it last until they regain their senses and then say no? Is that the government's position here?
No, the government's position is all we're trying to do is point out that there may exist a hypothetical set of circumstances where the statute can be constitutionally applied. Consent is something that typically occurs prior to the onset of sexual activity. That consent continues through. Whether that consent can be withdrawn in the middle, traditionally...
Well, we're not talking about withdrawal. We're talking about capacity.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so it's the government's position that even though the individual loses the capacity to grant consent, that act means that the consent somehow continues on until they regain the capacity and make an informed decision? I'm not sure where that ends.
You're working hard to prove they're different. Is it necessary for you to demonstrate they're different in order to determine that that portion of the statute is constitutional?
They don't have to be completely different, Your Honor. There can certainly be overlap. The case law is very clear that overlap is permissible so long as the jury members are properly instructed to make those distinctions and to make sure that the evidence is applied to both the...
Why are you working so hard then to find some imaginary time where you consent before you're incapacitated?
That was merely to make a point that it's...
Your brief spends a lot of time working on that issue, though.
Yes, Your Honor.
If that weren't the problem, if that isn't necessary to prove the statute's facially constitutional, why are you working so hard at it?
That is not the only way that the statute can be construed to be constitutional. There may be a variety of ways in which the statute can be found to be constitutional.
And what are some of those other ways?
One way is simply that the so long as under Martin v. Ohio and those related cases, just as this court found in Neal with the force versus consent, that the jury is properly instructed both in the content and the sequential nature of the instructions.
But we don't have a proper instruction here.
No, we don't. We haven't even gotten to the instructions. As long as it's theoretically possible for a judge to properly give those instructions, the statute survives any facial challenge.
Counsel, under a prosecution such as this, and you know, leaving aside the instructions that are actually given in this case, in order for a defendant to prove consent, wouldn't they necessarily have to prove that the putative victim was not substantially incapacitated?
The question of whether consent exists only looks, once again, and this gets back to why is the government looking at the temporal time difference does not have to be from the morning to the afternoon. It may be just a few minutes prior. The other issue here is that perhaps it's not a consent defense. It's a mistake of fact as to consent or a mistake of fact as to incapacity defense.
Are those different defenses or one defense? The CCA treated them as if they were the one, and it makes it a lot easier if mistake of fact is, if you're addressing mistake of fact versus consent. Are they one or two different defenses?
I would say as a theoretical matter, they could be two different defenses.
Theoretical, how about the difference between Section 14 and Section 15 of the statute? Aren't they two completely different defenses under the statute? I'm not talking about theory of criminal law, just mistake of fact and consent are two, aren't they two different defenses under this statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I thought I was addressing the mistake of fact as to whether mistake of fact as to incapacity is a different defense than mistake of fact as to consent. But yeah, the mistake of fact versus just a straight consent defense are certainly two different things.
Counsel, could you go back when you're done and answer the question that I asked you?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat, Your Honor?
Yes, how would, if the government has charged an individual with having sex with someone who is substantially incapacitated, and if someone who is substantially incapacitated cannot consent, how would an appellant raise evidence that showed that the putative victim had consented without having to disprove the substantial incapacity that the government's required to prove? How would that give me a precise circumstance in which that could happen?
The precise circumstance where that could happen is if the consent was given at some slightly different time than the
so that
when the consent was given, the person under the definition in 120T14 had the capacity to consent.
Is there any other circumstance that you can bring to our attention?
I in almost every other circumstance, the far more appropriate defense would be a mistake of fact.
And in that case, if substantial incapacity is a condition, under the definition of the statute means someone cannot consent, wouldn't that condition obviate any prior consent? And wouldn't, in that case, the defense that would be raised would be a mistake of fact as to consent, relying on the prior consent, as opposed to they actually consented because they weren't substantially incapacitated?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, that raises the issue that it may end up being that the statute is construed such that it offers a consent defense in the statutory language, but as a practical matter, if consent is only looked at the same time as the onset of the sexual activity, then there really is no set of circumstances where a consent defense can apply. So that Congress has offered an affirmative defense that in practical application never exists.
Thank you for your candor.
Yes. And the government's position is that does not render the statute unconstitutional. It just means that there is surplus language about the consent affirmative defense, but it does not take away from the accused any opportunity to raise other affirmative defenses such as a mistake of fact either as to consent or as to incapacity.
Counsel, is this the instruction that you would like a judge to give? That if the accused has testified that in the afternoon the two parties agreed to have sexual activity in the evening, that that's sufficient to raise the defense for purposes of getting an instruction, and that the judge would, and the alleged victim denies that there was any such conversation, that the judge would then instruct the panel, panel, if you believe the accused and determine by a preponderance of the evidence that there was consent in the afternoon to sexual activity that evening, you must acquit. Is that what we're talking about here in terms of the government's view of this statute?
If the consent to sexual activity was given with that incapacity in mind, if the person granting consent, and the example I gave is, I'm very tired, I may fall asleep, but I still consent to sexual activity.
Or another would be that we'll have sexual activity this evening and we'll use a certain type of incapacitating drug for whatever effect it might have. Your view is that that's a consent that carries through, and if the defense convinces the members by preponderance, that's a complete defense to whatever happens afterwards.
Yes, Your Honor, because there's nothing in the statute that says the consent must be absolutely contemporaneous with the sexual
activity. And do we have anything in this case that even suggests that that's an issue?
No, Your Honor. But once again, that would raise an as-applied issue rather than a facial challenge. The government merely propounds that theoretically could happen, even if it was an extremely rare case where the consent defense.
And why are we precluded in this case from considering the as-applied nature of this particular act and statute and charge?
Well, that issue was not granted. But if the court were to look at that, the court could certainly do so. The government would request an opportunity to brief that specific issue.
What authority did the military judge have to sever the statute?
I'm sorry, to sever the statute?
Yeah, it looks to me like the military judge severed the statute here without giving any analysis or any reason whatsoever. The military judge cut the affirmative defense right out of the statute. Is that an accurate view of what happened?
It does appear so, Your Honor.
Okay, what authority does the military judge have to sever a statute?
Well, if... He didn't say anything on the record, Your Honor, but if he made a determination that portion of the statute, the burden shifted in T-16, was unconstitutional, then he would have the authority to sever that unconstitutional.
Why does he have the authority to sever the statute as opposed to attempt to give a constitutional instruction? That is, to put it differently, where did the military judge get the authority to take away the affirmative defense from the accused in this case?
Well, my understanding is that he actually did instruct on the affirmative defense, and he actually put the accused in a better position because he instructed that the government had the burden of disproving the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Did he use the word affirmative defense?
I would have to review the record again, Your Honor, because I didn't brief that. That gets into the as-applied issue. But once again, the statute itself, Article 120C2 in isolation, is facially constitutional. The incorporating the extra language in Article 120 with the consent defense, it is possible to constitutionally apply that consent defense, even if it only comes up in extremely rare or unusual factual scenarios, or even never at all. The statute is still constitutional, and I draw the analogy to Article 120. S, which provides that all other affirmative defenses are available, that would include an affirmative defense of duress or necessity, and it would be hard to imagine any sexual assault case where an accused would prevail on a duress or necessity defense. Yet it nonetheless exists, and the mere fact that it exists does not render the statute unconstitutional. Here, even though a pure consent defense, as opposed to a mistake of fact as to consent or a mistake of fact as to incapacity defense, even if that pure consent defense is extremely rare, the fact that it only happens in extremely rare and unusual circumstances does not in itself render the statute unconstitutional.
If we have a concern, and we may not, but if we have a concern as to whether the judge improperly severed the affirmative defense in this case, Is this a matter in which we should receive further briefing here, or if it is a factually dependent matter, should we remand it to the Court of Criminal Appeals? What's the government's view on that?
Because the Court of Criminal Appeals already addressed the as-applied issue, I think the court could just ask for further briefing. There is also another court case today, U.S. v. Prather, where those issues are specifically addressed. Perhaps you could simply avoid the issue here, since this is a simple facial challenge, and address those issues in the next case.
Thank you.
Counsel, you appear to have suggested that you have some reservations, or that the government has some certain reservations about portions of the statute. Am I correct about that?
That would purely be limited to the Article T-16. The government certainly recognizes that there may be some difficulties in that portion of the statute.
And what is the government's view as to what should happen with that portion of the statute?
If the court were to reach that question today, I know that my Air Force colleague, Captain Porterfield, is prepared to address that specific question of how the burden shift works. I did not specifically brief that today, and if I may do so, I would request to defer to Captain Porterfield, who has prepared specific answers on that question that have arisen in her case. And once again, the government's position is the statute is facially valid, and the court requests this court to affirm the case.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I would like to clarify the position that Article 120C2, the elements standing alone, would be constitutional on their face. It's intuitive that the element of criminality in that offense is substantial incapacity, and that it is the reason it's a crime is because we recognize that having sex or sexual activity with a substantially incapacitated person, the reason it's a crime is because we know that they can't consent. Sexual conduct with a consenting adult is protected under Lawrence and Markham. So what really makes this a crime is the fact that they were, that because of their substantial incapacity, they therefore could not consent. So placing the burden upon the accused to disprove consent is the same thing as burdening him with proving the lack of substantial incapacity. To address the government's position on the scenario of what, if it's called a prior consent or anticipatory consent, we recognize that the two situations under which consent is legally impossible according to the statute. One is in which the victim.
Can I ask if Congress has given in your view, the appellant or an accused nothing, in the sense that in order to prove consent they have to disprove the element, does the burden shift, or is it just that Congress has given them a nothing burger? Do they have to disprove incapacity? Or is it just that they can't possibly prove consent without proving incapacity?
It's the latter, Your Honor.
They could sit there and do nothing. It's not like Mulaney, where they sit there and do nothing and the jury presumes something that they then have to jump up and rebut.
They could sit there and do nothing, Your Honor. However, the statute does create an affirmative burden to prove consent by preponderance, and that's what kind of...
Take that piece away.
Well, in that case, the accused still might not present any evidence at all, but if the government presented some evidence that indicated that the purported victim was actually consented, then that instruction would still have to be given, according to U.S. v. DePaola.
I understand where you're going. Thank you.
So the two situations under which consent is legally impossible, one is when the victim is under 16 years, and the second is when they're substantially incapacitated. We intuitively recognize that a 12-year-old female cannot give prior consent to sexual conduct. Likewise, when an alleged victim becomes substantially incapacitated, they cross over into that to becoming, legally speaking, like that 12-year-old. And that they just can't give consent as a matter of law.
Counsel, my understanding of the way the government refined its hypothetical would be a situation in which the two parties agreed to have sexual activity and as part of that sexual activity, there would be, let's say, an ingestion of a drug that would leave one party substantially incapacitated to say anything further at that point. The conversation probably wouldn't be that formal, but that would be the legal nature of it. And so in that situation, can the individual enter into an agreement to engage in sexual activity in which they would be sexually incapacitated? And if so, can they later complain about the nature of the sexual activity?
Your Honor, I see that my...
You can answer that question.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, they do not have the legal capacity to enter into that agreement because, again, of the definition of consent. It's by a competent person, and a substantially incapacitated person cannot consent. So the crime itself requires that the substantial incapacitation occur at the time of the act. Otherwise, there would be no crime. You wouldn't say that you had a sexual activity with a consenting person who is later incapacitated after the act, a sexual act had concluded, and say that that's a crime. The incapacity coexists with the act. That's what makes it a crime. And likewise, the consent must be contemporaneous with the act as well. There's no other, any other reading of that would be an unreasonable reading of the way that in which the affirmative defense operates.
Unless there are further questions, you may briefly conclude.
In conclusion, Pearl's position is that Article 120C2 is unconstitutional for the aforementioned three due process violations. Appellant respectfully asks this court to hold that it is unconstitutional on its face. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for the presentation today. Case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.
All rise.